Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
That's the sound of Washington right now. Gridlock. On climate change and the economy, and of course healthcare, a lot of Democrats are squirming in their seats.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No!
Now, for a lot on the right, gridlock is just fine. Here's Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, probably a presidential candidate for 2012. Just this weekend, he said he'd like to see Washington get about as far as a Tiger Woods SUV.
She said, no more. I think we should take a page out of her playbook and take a 9-iron. And smash the window out of a big government in this country.
When someone's swinging a 9-iron at your car, do you get out and cause a traffic jam? Or just hit the gas and go faster? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 22nd. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry for the better part of this week. I'm here with Celeste. You know, Celeste, the takeaway for me is gridlock is frustrating to a lot of people, but for people who don't like the president's agenda, and there are millions of them, gridlock might be a good thing. It slows him down.
Well, I'm a student of history, and for me the question is, when does gridlock actually work to make things better? Going to ask that question in a few minutes, I guess. Let's get right to the top stories this morning. Hoping to jumpstart the stalled health care bill, President Obama wants to give federal authorities the power to stop excessive rate hikes by insurance companies. That idea, along with the rest of his plan to overhaul health care, will be posted on the White House website for the first time in about an hour. This comes ahead of Thursday's televised meeting between Democrats and Republicans about health care.
A new poll this morning shows 86% of Americans believe the government is broken. All week, we're continuing a series called Frustration Nation. We'll take a look at the gridlock in Washington. Right now, we're joined by Julian Zelizer, a congressional historian. He's at Princeton University. Julian, gridlock seems to be so bad, and everyone seems to think it's the worst they've ever seen. Is that right? When we look back in history, really, is this the worst we've ever seen it?
No, I think sometimes we exaggerate how bad things are, meaning, you know, there are certain aspects of politics that aren't working well. We filibuster too much, so it seems you need 60 votes on everything. But if you look at a period like the 1960s, Democrats were complaining about the same thing. The committee chairs were blocking legislation. Southerners had been using the filibuster to stop civil rights. And there were all kinds of calls for congressional reform. And you could find that throughout American history. The system itself is kind of built toward gridlock.
The system itself, it seems to be built towards moving slowly, but that can be intensely frustrating. Well, we're going to get more historical context with you, Julian Zelizer, so stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
In Afghanistan, the government says a NATO airstrike has killed around 30 civilians. NATO confirms it fired on 3 minibuses. They believed it was a Taliban convoy. Lieutenant General Nick Parker is deputy commander of NATO-led forces in Afghanistan.
If we kill the people that we're actually trying to protect, our credibility is undermined, and therefore it is critical to us to avoid these sort of incidents occurring.
NATO Commander General Stanley McChrystal has apologized to Afghan President Hamid Karzai for the incident. Here at home, new credit card rules go into effect today. Companies won't be able to raise interest rates on existing balances.
Last night at the Olympics, U.S. men's hockey did something they haven't done in 50 years. They beat Canada in the Olympics. U.S. team captain Jamie Langebrunner says everyone contributed to the 5-3 win.
We had a pretty solid team effort tonight. We weathered some of their play where they were controlling it, but we did a good job of that, and we're able to battle through.
Now, also, American alpine skier Bodie Miller won his first gold medal yesterday. Coming up later in the hour, we talk more hockey because 3 decades ago, it was the Miracle on Ice U.S. over the Soviet Union. One of the guys on that team is now the coach of U.S. women's hockey, so stay tuned for that interview later in the show. He's going to be joining us. Turning to the markets now, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,402, and the S&P opens at 1,109. The NASDAQ opens at 2,243.
And we do start this new series this week, Frustration Nation, about the gridlock in Congress. And we're wondering, what do you think? Are you frustrated by what's going on in Washington right now? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post at our website, thetakeaway.org.
There is much too much ideology, not enough practical progress.
People are angry.
and they are frustrated that perhaps it hasn't been a fast enough change.
Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done.
I don't want you to feel discouraged.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Well, a new CNN poll finds that 86% of Americans think that government is broken. With so much anger over the state of politics right now, both inside and outside the Beltway in Washington, we're launching a series this week we're calling Frustration Nation. We want to examine the gridlock in Congress and in Washington and the state of disenchantment among the electorate. Last week, longtime Democratic Senator Evan Bayh announced he would not be running for re-election because, well, frankly, he's one of those 87%.
For some time, I've had a growing conviction that Congress is not operating as it should. There is much too much partisanship and not enough progress. Too much narrow ideology and not enough practical problem solving.
Well, that was interesting coming from Evan Bayh because he's not only a two-term senator himself, but his father was a senator. So he has seen how it works in his time. He saw how it worked when he was a boy in his father's time. And he says he's just about fed up, so much so that he doesn't want to work there anymore. Part of his reason anyway. Well, to kick off this series, we're joined today by Theda Scotchpole. She's professor of government and sociology at Harvard University. And back with us, Julian Zelizer, a congressional historian at Princeton and author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II. To the War on Terror. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks.
Nice to be here.
Good morning, Theda. Let me start with you. So many people say this is as bad as they've seen it. Evan Bayh strongly implies and has said this is as bad as he's seen partisanship and gridlock. What do you think? As bad as it gets?
Of course, slavery, civil rights, those were issues on which we saw protracted minority obstruction. I think it is pretty bad now in that this is the first time we have seen a minority after an election that their party lost badly decide to obstruct virtually everything in the program of a popular president.
Go ahead. This is new. Julian, you say it's not so new, that we've been around this merry-go-round before, that Washington is designed to move slowly.
Well, it's designed to move slowly, but we also reach periods where the system is kind of grinding to a halt, and presidents or congressional leaders start to feel great frustration, and it often leads to moments of reform. Again, the 1960s, ironically, when Lyndon Johnson can move legislation, is also one where a lot of this frustration is building up. But clearly, there are certain issues that are getting worse. The filibuster is one. Campaign finance reform is one. And a sort of scorched earth obstructionist policy by the Republicans is the final one.
How did we get here to scorched earth, Julian? Is it just a question of the ideas are so big? Let's take health care. The ideas are so big. There's so much money at stake that rather than let it pass, you have to get scorched earth. How do you think we got to this moment?
Well, part of it is kind of a incremental deterioration of the political battles between the two parties. And I do think, you know, there's a sense of seeing how far you can push these obstructionist mechanisms, and that's what we're seeing with the Republican Party. Part of it is just built-up tension over the last two decades of pretty big partisan polarization. And it seems, again, that the parties keep taking this further and further. And the Republicans are clearly kind of greatly frustrated that the story didn't turn out the way they wanted with united control of government in the early part of the 21st century.
Now, Theda Scotchpole from Harvard, one of the things that I hear from members of Congress about why their relationships are so bad, some of it's interpersonal. They don't spend time together anymore. They fly home every weekend. They don't have a drink together. They don't have dinner together. Do you think that's – how much of a role do you think that plays?
I think it plays a little role, but I actually think that the reason that the Republicans have turned to across-the-board obstructionism on everything, including the appointments to the president's administration, is because it works. It works in an era of 24-hour cable news where Americans just pick up sound bites. Most Americans have no idea that it takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass something. They think we voted for a party to try some new things, and nothing is happening. And remember, this is happening in a severe economic recession where millions of Americans have lost their jobs or are afraid of losing them and think that the only thing the parties can do together is bail out Wall Street.
Julian Zelizer, I'm curious. One analyst had said that what sets us apart from other historical eras of obstructionism is that the obstructionism is across the board. In other words, there's not just opposal to, on standards to civil rights or integration or segregation, but that even very routine, what would normally be routine legislation, gets blocked on principle.
I think that's a fair comment, and you can see that in the filibuster, meaning we've had a filibuster or filibusters throughout much of the history of the Senate. We didn't have cloture rules until early 20th century, but the filibuster was reserved in much of the 20th century for high-profile issues. So for something like civil rights, the filibuster was employed, and now what you see is the threat of a filibuster is used on almost anything, small legislation, big legislation, and I do think that is a significant change, and it's a bigger story about kind of using obstruction everywhere, especially in the last, you know, few months, rather than just in some places.
Theda Skocpol, if obstruction works in the modern age, whether it's media or in the jet age of Congress, and it's going to influence voters to throw the bums out, and in this case the bums are Democrats, what's the way out of this? How about a little bit of a roadmap here, how to end the obstruction? And the gridlock.
You know, I'm not sure there is a way out of this. And if Democrats are thrown out because Republicans cynically used across-the-board obstruction, that will not produce the result that voters will want. One of the problems that can happen, and it's happened in some European systems with fragmented parties, is that everybody obstructs, and then you get everything ground to a halt. On the other hand, if Democrats get back in, we'll see a lot of pressure on them to cooperate with the tax cuts for the rich that the Republicans want to put through. And in fact, in the past, they have let those through with less than 60 votes.
Theda Skocpol, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, and Julian Zelizer, congressional historian at Princeton University and author, joining us to talk about obstruction in Congress. You know, I had an interesting conversation with conservative Republican Congressman Jeff Fortenberry from Nebraska about why he thinks relations are dysfunctional between him and his colleagues. He's got an interesting take, so listen to it at thetakeaway.org. It's up there right now. We'll be continuing the series all week on Frustration Nation. We want to hear what you think about gridlock in Washington. 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post to the website at thetakeaway.org. Now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some of the stories we're following.
The president will be posting details of his new health care proposals in the next hour. Early this morning, First Lady Michelle Obama, speaking on CBS's Early Show, said the health care bill has to be passed.
We can't afford to give up, not in this country. You know, we're already seeing premiums going up for people who do have insurance, and there are still millions of Americans that are underinsured or uninsured.
Republicans and Democrats meeting at the White House on Thursday will discuss these new proposals. The Afghan government says it's unacceptable that civilians were killed in a NATO airstrike in southern Afghanistan on Sunday. It says at least 27 people, including women and children, were killed.
In Europe now, officials at the German national airline Lufthansa are asking a court to end the pilot strike that has left thousands of travelers stranded. The dispute centers on the transfer of jobs to foreign subsidiaries. The company hopes to have a court ruling by tomorrow. Internal memos at Toyota show officials bragged about saving the company $100 million by negotiating a limited recall in 2007 with U.S. regulators. Congressional hearings are set this week on Toyota's current global recall. Meanwhile, the UN has called for urgent action to prevent toxic waste from being discarded from electronic goods. It says many countries, including Mexico, face rapidly growing mountains of e-waste. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, who are the new poor in America? We talked to the New York Times Louise Story, who says it might be people who were once middle class. We talk more about that in just a few moments.
Hey, you want that to go?
Yeah, we've got your takeouts on news stories this week. And the first takeout comes from Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. They have their first article in a new series that examines the new poor. So, Louise, let's start there. Who are the new poor? New with a capital N.
The new poor in this series are the people who were comfortably in the middle class before the Great Recession that we have been going through began. And they're people who have now been unemployed for a long time. You know, there are more than 6 million people who have been unemployed for more than 6 months, which is the highest level since this stuff has been tracked, since the numbers of long-term unemployed have been tracked. And there's real questions about these formerly middle-class people, if they will ever get back to the middle class, because we don't know if there'll be job creation strong enough to take all these people back.
Well, we've been actually been the country and economists have been talking about the death of the middle class, the possible death of the middle class, for a very long time. Is that actually what we're seeing, or is this kind of, we don't know yet?
So what happens is every recession we've had in the last 20 years has gutted the middle class more and more. We're moving away from the 1950s. When you look at the figures, before 1990, it took about 21 months after a recession for the jobs that were lost to come back. In the 1990 recession, it took 31 months. In the 2001 recession, it took 46 months. It's taking longer and longer. This recession, 15 million unemployed. We don't know if they'll come back. And that's really because our economy is increasingly not a workers' economy. This is a profit shareholder return economy. And businesses, as they recover, are going to try to automate and only bring back the workers they really need. They're not going to be out trying to hire the masses.
Okay, Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
For our Nets takeout now, let's check in on Vancouver and the Olympics with Jason Stallman covering the Olympics for our partner, the New York Times. Jason, the ice dancing finals are tonight. We've got Canadians in the lead. We've got Americans in second and fourth place. Looks like we might have some good news for the U.S. on the podium tonight.
Certainly could see some good news for the United States. Perhaps Canada needs it more than the United States does, though, at this point.
On the ice, right.
They're own the podium program. You know that Canada sunk millions of dollars into this effort to finish atop the overall medals table, and the United States has been dominating so far. So, yeah, Canada would love to grab a medal in ice dancing or anything right now.
And staying on the ice, of course, women's hockey semifinals. What are the two matchups we have coming up?
Well, you have the United States playing Sweden and Canada against Finland. Based on the results so far in round-robin play, it really looks like it's going to be Canada against the United States for a gold medal. This is a sport that boils down to two teams, really. Same sort of thing that happened with women's softball before it was removed from the Olympic program. Two countries are dominating, and everybody else is trying to score a goal here and there.
The United States has been absolutely rolling over its opponents in hockey, sometimes with double-digit scores. We want to point out that later this morning, we're talking to the U.S. women's hockey coach and lead scorer for the 1980 Miracle on Ice team. Today marks the 30th anniversary of that U.S. hockey victory over the USSR in Lake Placid. You'll be able to hear the full interview on our website, thetakeaway.org, right after the show. Jason, thanks for being with us from Vancouver. Jason Stallman covers the Olympics for the New York Times.
And for our last takeout, we turn to California, where it may not be quite so golden for people who abuse animals. It turns out animal abusers could soon be treated like sex offenders in legal ways, anyway. To tell us how that works is Jesse McKinley, San Francisco Bureau Chief for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning.
In what ways are animal abusers in this proposal going to be treated like sex offenders?
Well, the basic concept is that the state, if they could pass this bill and get Arnold Schwarzenegger to sign off on it, would establish an online registry whereby anyone accused of felony-level animal cruelty charge would be listed online, very much in the way of sex offenders, with their name, their home address, their place of employment, and their criminal record.
And who would be looking at this online registry?
It would be open to anyone. Anyone who, you know, has an internet connection could essentially get online and find out if their neighbor had, you know, been convicted of running an animal fighting ring or hoarding or, you know, a variety of felony-level offenses. Now, keep in mind that most animal cruelty charges are actually misdemeanors, and it's somewhat rare for a prosecutor to actually go for a felony charge. But, you know, as we saw in a case like Michael Vick, it certainly does happen.
Yeah, but I guess the operative question here is what about the pound? Are they going to check that registry before they allow someone to adopt an animal? What about a pet store?
Conceivably, that would be one of the uses. In talking to prosecutors about this, particularly with puppy mills, places that generate large numbers of dogs, sometimes illegally, a lot of these people will skip from state to state to state, basically looking for a jurisdiction where they're not going to be prosecuted or not gone after with the same intensity. So backers of this idea think that this would be a great way for people to kind of track these people as they move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Are other states considering doing programs like this?
Tennessee had taken this up in 2008. It got through the Senate. I think it stalled after that. This idea has been around for a little bit. It's been tinkered with. But in California, which has a very strong record of animal rights laws, in particular Proposition 2, which outlawed battery cages for egg-laying hens. The state's voters have seemed to be very, very much in favor of this, and the backer of this, Dean Flores, who's the Senate Majority Leader, seems to think he's got the votes to get it through.
And, well, you know, we're seeing this kind of thing in other areas of law enforcement. They not only have this for child sex offenders, but they also have John's TV I've seen in many cities, and now this with animal abusers. Is this perhaps law enforcement trying to use broadened communication to crack down?
Certainly, and I think that for some civil libertarians, this is also somewhat troubling in that it turns people on a level of animal abuse into pariahs. But the backers of this, which include this group called the Animal Legal Defense Fund, feel very strongly that this is simply publishing public records and using that information to kind of keep people aware of who they're living next to or hiring.
Okay, Jesse McKinley is the San Francisco Bureau Chief for our partner at the New York Times. Coming up, we'll continue our coverage of the ongoing Allied offensive in southern Afghanistan and look at how the campaign in Marja differs from a typical military operation and how the word is getting out on PR about that campaign. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Coming up, the military is trying a number of different tactics in this offensive on Marja in southern Afghanistan. We're going to talk to you about those in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the headlines we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. For the first time, we're getting a look at the nuts and bolts of President Obama's plan to overhaul health care. They'll be posted on the White House website in half an hour. A new addition is the president's plan to give federal authorities the power to limit rate hikes by insurance companies. At the top of the hour, you can read the proposals at thetakeaway.org as well as hear reaction to them. This comes ahead of Thursday's televised meeting between Democrats and Republicans about health care. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell tells CBS News Americans are fed up with partisanship.
Sooner or later, you've got to compromise. You've got to start making the compromises that arrive at a consensus and move the country forward.
And from the headlines to you, we're starting this new series this week called Frustration Nation. We're wondering if you're frustrated by what's going on in Washington.
This is Paul from Rhode Island. This attitude, a plague on all politicians, they're all no good. I mean, grow up, people. Who put them there in the first place? Who listened and paid attention to their advertising?
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
A new credit card rules go into effect today. They'll shield you from sudden interest rate hikes. Earlier on The Takeaway, personal finance expert Beth Kobliner told us one key change is that people under 21 can no longer get a credit card without a job or without a parental co-signature.
Up until now, college kids have been bombarded with credit cards. They have, on average, $4,100 in credit card debt. That's not going to happen anymore.
Beatles fans are breathing a sigh of relief. That's because Abbey Road, the London recording studio that made the Beatles famous, is safe. Struggling music company EMI had said last week they may sell Abbey Road. Now news is that potential buyers are stepping back and EMI is stepping back. Abbey Road is safe for the moment. Now let's turn to Wall Street. The markets are open. The Dow is up 12 points. The S&P is up 2 points. And the NASDAQ is up about 7 in early trading. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
As we've been reporting all morning, a NATO airstrike has killed a number of civilians in Afghanistan. The Afghan cabinet is now saying 27 people are dead after a strike on a suspected Taliban convoy that turned out to be full of civilians. Chris Morris is a BBC reporter who joined us earlier this morning from Kabul, Afghanistan. And I asked Chris to give us the details of this NATO airstrike.
This is something that happened on Sunday morning, local time. NATO said it thought Taliban insurgents in the province of Uruzgan, which is just north of Helmand, where Operation Mushtarak, the big operation, is taking place, thought the Taliban there were about to attack a joint Afghan and NATO military unit. They called in the airstrike, hitting three minibuses. But when people arrived on the ground, it pretty soon became clear that women and children were among the dead and wounded. The Afghan cabinet's now put out a statement saying initial reports suggest at least 33 people have been killed and that all of them were civilians, and it described the airstrike simply as unjustifiable. I think an indication of the level of anger, understandably in many, many ways, among all sections of Afghan society whenever an incident like this takes place.
That was Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul, Afghanistan. He joined us earlier this morning. We have with us now Tom Shanker. He's the Pentagon correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. And he's written an analysis of this campaign that details what sets it apart from other offensives. Tom, you wrote about something that I found fascinating. You talked about some polling done in Afghanistan by U.S. officials. That seems strange as part of a military campaign. What is that about?
Well, that's exactly right. You don't really associate military campaigns with polling. That's more a tool of political campaigns. But that just proves how political are the goals of the Marja offensive now underway in Helmand Province. Before the offensive began, the military and other parts of the government did quite a bit of polling in the region to try to find out what the residents thought about the Americans, about the central government, about the insurgents, and what the central government and its U.S. ally could do to make the citizens feel safe and earn their support. Now, to be sure, you know, one can only imagine what the margin of error is when there are entire villages where you risk your life going in, but the military thought this was an important tool to have in hand before the offensive started.
This civilian deaths was specifically one thing that they were trying to avoid in this Marja offensive, and that was new as well. So does this NATO airstrike damage that?
Of course, anytime innocent civilians, non-combatants are killed in a military operation, it undermines the exact goal of what General McChrystal is trying to do, which is to get, you know, the fearful and the fence setters in Afghanistan to move from either supporting the Taliban or a neutral position into supporting the central government. The entire offensive in Marja, you know, yes, it's carried out with bullets and bombs and all of that, but its goal is not, you know, only to kill the adversary or only to seize territory. It's all about shifting perceptions of the Afghan population to support their government. Civilian deaths are absolutely counter to that, and that's why also in advance of Marja, the military signaled long before it came in that the offensive was coming. If all the bad guys had left town, that would have been fine, but they wanted the civilians to get to safe locations in an attempt to minimize the death of non-combatants.
You know, you talked about how for the past 6 months the military was trying to learn from the Taliban in terms of winning the war for hearts and minds. What kind of strategies or hints did they take from their enemies to work on the civilians?
Well, the real thing that the Taliban can do is they're very agile. They can trumpet their successes on the internet and over the radio and over these kind of threatening night letters that they deliver. The one advantage the Taliban has, of course, is they can lie anytime they want. If the American military puts out a press release that's false, the reporters on the ground will find that out and uncover it, and that too undermines the mission. But what General McChrystal tried to adapt was a strategy of changing the momentum of depicting the central government in Kabul and its partners in the coalition military as winners to try to drown out the Taliban narrative that they were in control.
So how quickly does news travel? Will the people in the city of Marja already know about the NATO airstrike that killed civilians in the province above them?
Yeah, inside the city of Marja, it's doubtful. There's still a full-scale military operation there. But across the rest of Afghanistan, the Oruzgan tragedy is, of course, immediately known.
And in what way can they minimize the damage? Are they doing it right by General Stanley McChrystal immediately apologizing to Hamid Karzai? Is that the right move to take?
That's the new strategy that Secretary Gates imposed about it a year ago. Rather than have the lengthy and long military investigation, when there were examples of civilian deaths, the military would apologize first, investigate later, not the other way around.
Tom Shanker is the Pentagon correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. We're going to see if this new strategy actually works in Marja. In the meantime, if you have anything that you want to share about something you've heard on the show, like Afghanistan, you can tell us.
Tom from Seabright, New Jersey. At the recent deaths of 30 or so civilians in Afghanistan, come on, Obama, stop killing in my name. You're not accomplishing anything over there that is, has anything to do with the safety of our citizens, okay? It might be good for business or globalization, but it's not good for anything else.
You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to the site, thetakeaway.org.
We're also starting a new series this week, Frustration Nation. We examine the gridlock in Congress and the roiling anger from voters. Are you frustrated by how government's running in Washington? What's your solution?
This is Rick Boyer from Detroit, Michigan. I don't buy the vocal minority of people being angry at the politicians in Washington. Everyone says they're angry and they should be removed, but every year the people keep sending the bombs back to Washington.
Now, some of you are getting creative and telling us in just six words.
Build electric cars, fix American economy.
Lauren in Boston,
totally frustrated with this crazy Congress.
Well, tell us your take at 8778-MYTAKER. Post to the website at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, check out an interview I did with Congressman Jeff Fortenberry. He's a conservative Republican, and he has his take from the inside about why relations are so dysfunctional between him and his colleagues.
Coming up, we're going to talk about hockey. Not just the men's victory yesterday over Canada, but 3 decades ago, the U.S. men's hockey team performed the miracle on ice. They beat the Soviet Union. Now, one member of that team is hoping for another victory, this time as coach of the U.S. women's team. He's going to join us later for that conversation. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's about this time of year that high school seniors start applying for college. They're filling out applications. They're writing personal essays, collecting those letters of recommendation, and also breaking out the camera phones.
I can apply my hand-eye coordination and make it into something really complex and beautiful, like a piece of music. Or apply it to solving something that can, in the end, be really simple.
Okay, well, you maybe recognize the sound of the piano on one end. That's high school senior Connor Buckley in a video essay that he made. But you may not recognize on the other side, he was actually solving a Rubik's Cube. That's part of a YouTube video essay he made as part of his application to Tufts University. And this was all a brainchild of my next guest, Lee Coffin, the Dean of Undergraduate Admissions at Tufts University in Boston. Dean, you said that the YouTube video, idea is causing quite a bit of talk on the campus.
Good morning. It's caused quite a stir, and it's been exciting to watch it play out.
Well, how did you come up with this idea?
Well, the idea hatched almost serendipitously last spring. We were talking about this year's essay questions, and the thought occurred to us that this is a group that was born in 1992. They've lived out their entire life in the internet era, with access to social media and the transparency that comes with it. And we thought maybe there's a new opportunity here to create a different storytelling moment for the applicants. And so we thought let's give them an option to do a 1-minute video posted on YouTube as a way of showing us a new part of themselves that wouldn't necessarily come through in a traditional written form.
Is there an income barrier? Is there a certain level of financial stability that a student has to have in order to have access to video equipment?
No, you know, what's been really gratifying to note is about 60% of our video essay submitters have also applied for financial aid. And I think that speaks to the democratization of technology. And so most kids these days have access to a laptop or a camera or a cell phone that has the video capability. And we're not asking students to do Oscar-winning short films. We're saying, sit before a camera and tell us about yourself in your own words in a way that gives us a new perspective on who you are. And some of them have been really simple and crude and compelling, and others have been very high-tech and impressive that a high school senior is able to pull that off.
Well, you know, since they're YouTube essays, these are things that everybody has access to and can watch. Right. So do people start lobbying you on who they think should get in?
There has, yes, some lobbyists have sprouted up, mostly among our undergraduates, have stumbled upon the YouTube videos and are posting comments to the admission committee urging us to admit someone. One girl said, you know, if you don't take her, I won't accept my diploma at graduation. And, you know, it's charming. We're not paying any attention to that because the video essay is really one piece of our broader evaluation of a candidate. But it's fun to see the way the videos have both caught the imagination of the applicants but also our current students. And I think it speaks to the way this generation of college students uses video and related social media as another way of expressing themselves.
Okay, he's the Dean of Undergraduate Admissions at Tufts University in Boston. Thanks so much, Lee Coffin.
My name is Amelia Downs, and I'm here to show you how I combine two of my favorite things, being a nerd and dancing.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry, and I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Well, coming up, we're talking hockey because 3 decades ago, U.S. men's hockey team performed what's known as that miracle on ice when they beat the Soviet Union. Now, a member of that team is hoping for another victory in Vancouver, this time as coach of U.S. women's hockey. We're talking to him in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. In the next 15 minutes, the president will be posting the details of his new healthcare proposals for the first time. You can read those proposals and hear a reaction on thetakeaway.org. On Thursday, there's a televised debate between Republicans and Democrats on the new proposals. It's a healthcare summit at the White House. Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania says Republicans need to come to this meeting with an open mind.
They can't just say no on Thursday. The American people are watching, and they're watching clearly. You take some of our ideas, we'll take some of your ideas. We may not love your ideas, but we'll take them.
Later on today, the president will meet with several governors to hear their health care ideas. The Afghan government says it's unacceptable that 27 civilians were killed in a NATO airstrike in southern Afghanistan on Sunday. Lieutenant General Nick Parker is deputy commander of NATO-led forces in Afghanistan.
If we kill the people that we're actually trying to protect, our credibility is undermined. And therefore, it is critical to us to avoid these sort of incidents occurring.
An investigation has been launched into the airstrike.
Here at home, military chiefs will be testifying before Congress on whether gays should be able to serve openly in the military, the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell law. Congress is deciding whether to repeal that legislation. And with 7 gold and 24 medals overall, the United States leads the medal tallies at the Winter Olympics. Last night was particularly special. You may have missed it. The United States hockey team beat Canada. First time in 50 years.
Could have missed it.
Kind of a big moment. Also in alpine skiing, Bodie Miller took home a gold medal. That's his first. Iran has issued a warning that airlines will be banned from flying into its airspace unless they use the term Persian Gulf to describe that stretch of water that separates Iran from its southern neighbors. We were joined earlier by John Lyne, BBC Iran correspondent in London, and we asked him, why does the Iran government care what people are calling it?
Well, I can tell you that when I was based in Iran, I did a story once which I thought was pretty heavily critical of Iran's human rights record, and I was quite scared about the response. And the only thing they criticized me for was the fact that I'd called it the Gulf and not the Persian Gulf. It's a matter of huge importance to Iran. They see it, I think, when it's not called that, as an insult to their history and, of course, their 2,500-year-old history and more of the civilization and their culture. So it is a matter of massive importance to them.
John Lyne is a BBC Iran correspondent. He joined us from London. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Now, U.S. hockey is on a tear in Vancouver. Last night, the men's team upset the Canadians 5-3, and there's some Olympic hockey history in the air this week. Today is the 30th anniversary of one of the biggest upsets in the history of the Olympics and in the history of hockey, when those scrappy college kids from the U.S. men's hockey team beat the USSR, the Soviet Union. Mark Johnson was on that team, and now he's looking for another gold in this Olympics in Vancouver, but this time he's coach of Team USA's women's hockey team. The U.S. women play in the semifinals against Sweden later on today. We spoke with Mark Johnson last week from Vancouver. He was the lead scorer in that magnificent game in 1980, and I asked him if that performance inspires his players now.
Well, hopefully. I mean, not too often as an athlete you get to play in the Olympic Games, and certainly the expectations back in 1980 when we're playing are a little bit different than the team I'm running right now, it's still the Olympics. It's still an opportunity to represent your country. And for this group of players that I'm coaching, it's an opportunity to win a gold medal. And it's exciting, and certainly we've got a lot of energy within our squad.
You know, the United States women's team has blown by Finland 6-0, blown by Russia 13-0, blown by China 12-1, facing Sweden this afternoon. It's safe to say, I think, that your team has not been well-tested yet. So how are you expecting to fare in the rest of the tournament here?
Well, obviously, the next game, as you mentioned, against Sweden, we play this afternoon. It's going to be an important game from the standpoint. If you're victorious and you're successful in that game, you get an opportunity to play for a gold medal. So to me, it's the toughest game of the tournament. Sweden in 2006 beat the United States in this exact game. So
right.
We're going to have our hands full just because of the meaning of the game.
Meanwhile, Sweden itself was blasted by Canada 13-1. What intel do you derive from that result?
Well, obviously, the Canadians have a very strong team. They're playing in their home country and their home soil, and they got a lot of offensive players that are very dangerous. And in sports, you can have good nights and bad nights. And for Canada, they had a very good night against Sweden, and unfortunately, the Swedes didn't play very well. But they'll forget that quickly because, as I mentioned, the team that wins that game between ourselves gets an opportunity to play for a gold medal. So there's a lot on the line, and certainly both teams are going to come out and try to play their best hockey.
Mark Johns, let's take a step back for a minute, because I know you know about the concern about the balance in women's hockey right now. You have teams like the United States, like Canada, really dominating the world, and I just went through some of the results, 13-0 over Russia, 12-1 over China. Of course, Canada rolling over Sweden 13-1 and an even bigger result against Slovakia. There are people out there who want to put Olympic women's hockey on hold until there's better competition for the U.S. and Canada. Would that be a good idea?
No, I don't think it would be. I don't think it'd be fair to certainly several of the countries that are doing things the right way. It's, to me, it's such a new sport. It hasn't been around long enough to warrant the opportunity to say, hey, let's put this on hold and wait a few more years for these other countries to catch up. You go back to the early Olympics, you look at men's ice hockey, the scores were even worse than what you're seeing in the women's side here the last couple of Olympics. Finland's got much better over the last several years. Sweden's doing a nice job. China's starting to make progress. It takes time, and I think sometimes we have to be patient. I know the other countries are working hard. Unfortunately, some of the federations in those areas, aren't putting the resources into it right now, and hopefully in the future it'll continue to grow, it'll continue to prosper, and these countries will continue to improve.
Right. Most people probably don't know that your women play a schedule against high school hockey players for two reasons. One, the speed is kind of matched, but also it's kind of hard to find competition elsewhere in the world right now.
Well, it is, and for us and certainly for Canada, Sweden's done the same thing. Actually, Finland's played against some boys' teams this year.
Right.
When you put together your Olympic rosters, you have the best players that your country has to offer, and so you're looking for competition. And usually that that 16, 17, 18-year-old boy is probably the right level. You start getting into 19- and 20-year-olds in the junior level, and we played a couple of those teams this year. That might be a little bit stretching it. It's good competition, but I think that if you have the best players on the female side, for us to play against boys' high school teams, gives us competition that makes us a better hockey team.
They call your 1980 performance, of course, the miracle on ice when the United States men's team beat the Soviet Union, called the Soviet Union at the time, at Lake Placid. If your women pull out a gold medal here, and we all hope they do, in the 2010 Olympics, would you call it a miracle on ice? Certainly a great achievement, but not quite the same underdog status, not even close to what you all faced against the Soviets.
No, as I mentioned, the expectations of this squad when we started in August is our goal is to win the gold medal. I mean, back in 1980, I don't think any of us on that squad, anyone within our staff was thinking about winning a gold medal. But
right.
This team I've got right now, we've been preparing, training. They've been working hard. They've committed themselves, for many years here to get this opportunity. And, certainly when the expectations are high, kids work extremely hard, and then they're going to put themselves in position. They've prepared, and now there are opportunities in front of them. So this isn't going to be a miracle. This is a lot of time commitment, a lot of work on a lot of people's part.
Yeah, you're right. It's no miracle. It's a lot of hard work. U.S. women's hockey is rolling strong in Vancouver. Three wins under their belt. They play Sweden this afternoon under the leadership of Mark Johnson. He's the coach and also former player of 1980 U.S. men's hockey, the so-called miracle on ice. Mr. Johnson, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We spoke to Mark Johnson last week, and for more excitement on the Olympics, you can catch all of our coverage. We have interviews with the skaters Vanessa James and Yannick Bonneur, fashion designer Nick Varios talking about costumes, and takeaway correspondent Femi Oké went out to Central Park to talk to young, possibly future Olympic skaters. That's at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can sign up for our newsletter as well. We're also starting a new series this week called Frustration Nation. We're wondering if you're frustrated with what's going on in Washington.
This is Walter from Detroit. The Democrats now are them cowards because they're not doing anything. There was an election, and there's 59 of them and 41 Republicans, and they won't do anything. So I'm pretty fed up with the situation that's going on in Washington.
Give us your take, 8778-MY-TAKE, or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're also on that website going to have the details of President Obama's health care reform proposal coming up in just a few minutes. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. For the next couple of days, this is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.